As predicted, wind is picking up again at this hour on the Lolo Creek Fire Complex. Good evening. I'm Edward O'Brien.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic.
And that fire complex west of Lolo, Montana, again, tops our newscast. Well, it was another hot and dry day today, and that fire has, the estimates have it, burned so far 4 homes confirmed. Montana Public Radio News Director Sally Mock is attending a public meeting underway at this hour at the Lolo School. Sally.
Hello, Ed. Yes, I'm here outside the Lolo School, the lower gymnasium, which is filling up with residents. There are probably a couple hundred people here so far, and people still filing in. And they're here to learn a lot more from the people who are managing this fire about just what they can expect in the coming days. The fire, as expected, grew today. They now estimate it's at least 8,000 acres. The last estimate we had yesterday was 5,000. And if you look south from Missoula, you can see the growing plume. This morning was fairly calm, but as expected, the winds picked up today, this afternoon, and spread the fire even further. But I have to say, having been here most of the day, the winds were not as bad today as they were yesterday when the fire really blew up. So that's the small bit of good news.
And they started early yesterday, around 2:30, 3 o'clock, something like that, right?
Right, and the wind started a little bit later today and not as much force, so we'll take that as a good sign.
I don't know if you know this, but what is the plan of attack? What have you heard?
Well, that's what this meeting is about, and they're going to brief people on how they plan to manage the fire. They're going to brief people on what the current pre-evacuation and evacuation plans are, and they're just going to kind of do an overall update. And they've spent today as a transition today between teams managing the fire. A Type 1 incident command team is going to take over the fire tomorrow. And so today was kind of the handoff on that. I think they're going to have a briefing with the new team after this meeting. So it's been kind of a regroup kind of day, and everyone taking a breath and hoping that in the coming days they can get a handle on this fire, because right now they don't.
Mm-hmm. Highway 12, it was hoped, would be reopened at least on a very limited basis earlier today, but maybe not so much.
Well, it hasn't happened yet. They're kind of evaluating that on a sort of hourly basis. They do want to at some point get it open to essential travel, because it is such a throughway for a lot of commercial interests, among others. They have opened the Fish Creek Road, which is a way you can get over the mountains from I-90, from Interstate 90 over to Highway 12, but that's a long, kind of not a very good shape road, but it is a way that would cut some hours off for people who need to get in.
Okay. Anything else on your end?
Well, I think, Ed, as I said, I think we're going to know a whole lot more after this meeting, and we'll have updates online, and, of course, we'll have as fresh information as we can tomorrow.
Tomorrow morning on Montana Morning News. Thank you, Sally, so much.
You bet.
Well, earlier today, Sally traveled up Sleeman Gulch, a few miles east of the fire off Highway 12, to talk to some of the residents there. They've been placed on pre-evacuation notice, meaning they need to be ready to leave on the spur of the moment. Sleeman Road is a gravel road with only one way in and one way out. Kirk Derby lives almost at the end of the road in a house he and his wife just bought a year ago. Last night, they left to wait out the fire in town, but returned today to clear some more stuff from their house.
One thing we really realized yesterday, what's most important to us as far as what we took out of the house.
Computer, pictures.
Well, the precious stuff. Yes, that's right. Pictures, photographs, and, just the really precious products. And as far as the property goes, yeah, you're starting to realize what really needs to be done all the time, things need to be kept as far as the just everything, keeping wood away from the house and keeping the grass short and green as possible.
Rob McDonough has lived on Sleeman Road for 20 years and seen a lot of fires, but this year, he says, seems different.
We're ready to leave if we have to, but we're going to stay here and just try to help out as much as we can.
How's this compare to, you mentioned 2000, which was a terrible year in the Bitterroot, and 2003 was another scary year. How's this compare, this situation?
I think this is a little bit more worse because conditions are drier, and we've had a lot of, soot and ambers coming down around the house. I mean, very large pieces. And that's the concern here, because everything's so dry that if the winds pick up and one of them, if they're still hot, they could start other spot fires. So that's what we're kind of more concerned about.
You want to stay and defend until it's not safe.
Yes, that's correct.
But don't save the house and lose yourself.
No. If it comes down to leaving, if they say you have to leave, then I'm going to leave. But until then, I plan to stay here.
Noted author James Lee Burke is also a longtime resident. He was moving his two Tennessee walking horses out of his place on Sleeman today just as a precaution.
Came out to Montana in 1966, you know. John Steinbeck said it many years ago, Montana is not a state, it's a love affair.
And it's also a place where fire is a part of the environment.
Well, they're worse, though. There's no question about it. I mean, we're drying out the planet. That's my view. But I don't think it's... Look, I'm from Louisiana. Average rainfall in the state of Louisiana in the year 1950 was 90 inches a year. Today, it's about 30 inches. How does anyone argue with the conclusions that kind of statistic leads us to? It's, you know, we have to do things differently. We've got to start accepting the fact that Earth's a lot warmer than it used to be, and we're drying out our environment. Beetles, fires are, you know, the consequence.
And those are just some of the voices of the Highway 12 residents coping with the Lolo Creek Complex fire. There is just a bit of good news in the midst of this, chaos. The Missoula County Sheriff's Office said a man has been found safe after being reported missing while berry picking near Lolo Creek Monday, just before the fire spread to the area. His name is Mark Hanna, and he apparently became disoriented and was separated from a friend as the two headed back because of the thickening smoke. Sarah.
It's a different story in the Flathead area. Fire danger remains at high as a few fires have sparked in the Flathead National Forest. Near Lakeside on the west side of Flathead Lake, the Stoner Creek fire is burning a little, a couple of miles away from the community. Catch and Fry reports the fire is burning on acreage right next to an area burned in the 2009 fire season.
On the drive to Lakeside, sailboats are out taking advantage of windy conditions on Flathead Lake under a bright blue sky. Public Information Officer Wade Muehlhoff with the Flathead National Forest says the wind hasn't been hampering firefighting efforts, and crews on the Stoner Creek fire are making good progress.
Folks out here will notice today they don't see a plume of smoke. We've been able to beat this fire down. It's not out, but we've been able to beat it down. Now we have to establish a really good perimeter, good fire line around the entire fire, and make sure that we deal with any of the hot spots.
Muehlhoff says crews will continue monitoring the fire, but they hope to begin ramping down work on the Stoner Creek fire and start freeing up resources to help with other fires by Wednesday. The cause of this fire remains under investigation. Muehlhoff says the fire started around 5 or 6 in the evening on Sunday the 18th. He says it's only about 2.5 miles from Lakeside as the crow flies up the road leading to the Blacktail Mountain ski area. He says no structures are directly threatened at this time. The Stoner Creek fire is directly east of the Baldy fire of 2009. That fire burned about 250 acres and prompted evacuation notices for more than 100 people.
And that's why it really was a priority Monday morning when the fire managers got on scene. They knew they needed to hit this hard and fast and get control of it very quickly, because we didn't want a repeat of 2009 where we have evacuations and where homes are threatened.
Helicopters spent Monday dumping water on the blaze, while efforts Tuesday focused on the ground, with crews working on a fire line and mop-up. 80 firefighters are working on the Stoner Creek fire, with 2 helicopters on standby, 6 engines, and a bulldozer. By the end of the day Tuesday, it's considered 50% contained. Muehlhoff says there are a total of 10 fires burning in the Bob Marshall Wilderness. He says most are less than a quarter of an acre. 2 fires near the southern end of the wilderness area have seen initial attack actions, with smoke jumpers brought in for suppression efforts. The other 8 are not being actively managed. Fire officials have protected Forest Service cabins and lookouts in the area, are monitoring the fires, but letting nature take its course. Muehlhoff says they are all considered to be lightning-caused. The Damnation Fire is the largest, at more than 2,200 acres, burning about 20 miles southeast of Swan Lake, along the South Fork Flathead River Corridor. Muehlhoff says the Flathead has seen just enough more moisture to keep the fire danger in the area in check.
The Flathead Valley was fortunate in that we got a fair amount of substantive moisture here just a few weeks ago, and so that's kept especially the northern end of the valley damper than other places. We are starting to dry out, though, and people still need to be extremely careful with their fires. Anytime there's a human-caused fire, that takes resources away from the other fires that we're out managing.
Weather forecasters call for continued hot, dry, windy conditions, and fire officials are reminding people in the Flathead that open burning season remains closed until the end of September, and to be careful with campfires and operating equipment that can produce a spark. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
And in other news from around the state, the environmental organization Earth First is circulating a guidebook on how to sabotage the hunting of wolves. The online guide lays out steps for destroying wolf traps, releasing trapped wolves, and disrupting wolf hunts through methods such as smoke bombs and air horns. It asserts states, the NRA, and the Obama administration are engaging in a conspiracy to wipe wolves off the face of the planet. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks strongly disagrees.
Earth First media correspondent Panayoti Cholkas says the organization received the Wolf Hunt Sabotage Manual from an unknown group calling itself the Redneck Wolf Lovin' Brigade. He says the manual fits in line with the mission of Earth First, which holds as a slogan, "No compromise in the defense of Mother Earth."
Sabotaging hunting has been going on for a long time and pretty much as far back as the Endangered Species Act goes.
The 12-page manual details strategies for how to find traps set in the woods and how to dismantle them. It talks about using cross-country skis to be more quiet or carrying a white bedsheet for emergency snow camouflage. It advocates leaving nails along roads trappers might be driving to pop their tires. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks spokesman Ron Ausheim says the department is used to emotional reactions from the public.
This certainly, though, is somewhat over the top as far as things that we would typically see even here at Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. When you advocate breaking the law, which this certainly does, that's above and beyond what's acceptable.
Ausheim says tampering with traps is illegal, and the guide talks about how to release a trapped wolf back into the wild. Ausheim says that's not only illegal, it's dangerous.
You bet it's dangerous, and some of their techniques, you know, you're talking about a wild animal, a predator, and other 100-pound animals.
When you say it's illegal to interfere with wolf hunting, in my opinion, it's the right thing to do.
Again, Earth First's Panayoti Cholkas.
There can be a case made for it that it's actually upholding a law more accurately than the government is currently upholding its own laws.
Cholkas believes best science shows wolves should still be on the endangered species list. He says the way wolves are being managed today is based on lobbying interests.
I would say in this case, the industry of hunting and the trophy aspect of it, along with the cattle industry, who, you know, have usurped large amounts of public land in the West and want their interests protected, I would say those are the forces that are guiding the policy.
Ron Ausheim with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks disputes that. He says wolves in Montana are well above and beyond minimum population goals. If anything, the department is looking to lower the population.
What we're trying to do is get to balance. Wolves are healthy. We're committed to a recovered population. So that's where we're at, and that's where we'll remain.
He says anyone caught breaking these laws will face consequences, including fines and, in some cases, jail time. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Planned Parenthood of Montana's new president and CEO, Martha Stahl, says she's a natural fit for the organization. Stahl describes her mom as a very strong woman with a passion for women's rights issues, while her dad is a United Church of Christ pastor. She says her family was always interested in social justice and equality for all. Stahl is the third president and CEO in Planned Parenthood of Montana's four-decade history. She left her position as vice president of external affairs for Planned Parenthood of the North Country, New York, where she's worked for the past 9 years. In this evening's feature, Stahl talks with Edward O'Brien about Planned Parenthood's many successes and significant challenges.
It's amazing that access to an annual exam, access to cancer screenings, STI testing and treatment, birth control, you know, it's things that I think a lot of us can take for granted and not realize how meaningful that is to our patients and what a difference it really makes practically in their lives.
Does it ever get exhausting being involved in an organization that is such a lightning rod? I mean, it's practically ground zero for America's cultural and political divide, if you will.
It can be tiring. It can be frustrating. But I think the mission is what keeps us all going. You know, knowing that we are having that day-to-day impact on the patients, you know, on people who see our educators out in the community. You know, there's a lot of conversation, it's a very loud conversation, I think, right now in our country around issues related to women's health care. And it's not just about abortion anymore. It's about access to contraception. It's about access to health care in general. I think that Planned Parenthood is really uniquely positioned because we understand that things are not black and white for people. We understand the services that we provide, and we see that impact on a daily basis. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity in this country to have a different conversation about these issues. You know, the issue of abortion, for example, it's deeply, deeply personal, and people have very strong feelings about it.
And it is black and white, isn't it?
I think that there are folks in this country who would like to paint it that way. But if you talk to your average person on the street, it's not black and white. You know, we all have in our mind our own values about these things, and I think that's perfectly okay. My feeling on it, and Planned Parenthood's stance in general, is that it's absolutely fine for people to have conflicting ideas and opinions about all of these issues. All that we're asking is that women be allowed to make decisions about their health care, not just about abortion, but their health care in general. Keep that decision between the woman, her doctor, her family, and her faith, if she's a person who is practices a spiritual practice or has a religion that she associates with. And that's really, I think, the basic. And I think actually that's something that a lot of people agree when they think about their own lives and they think about really it is complicated. And we can't walk in a woman's shoes. You know, we have to trust that she's going to make the best decision for her. And so I think it's a different conversation that needs to happen. The labels don't work for people. For some people they do, but I think that's a very narrow part of the population who calls themselves pro-life or pro-choice, and that has a meaning that other people understand.
How would you characterize Planned Parenthood's funding and just general volunteer support right now?
The upside of being a lightning rod, as you say, is more and more people know about what we do. We've always had a strong trust and recognition with people who are our patients and former patients. But now you can go anywhere in this country and say Planned Parenthood, and people say, I know what Planned Parenthood is. I think we have work to do on letting people know what our services are, making sure that potential patients know that we're for them. We serve all kinds of people. We serve people with insurance. We serve people without insurance. We serve young women. We serve men. We serve teenagers. All that kind of diversity. I think people sometimes imagine Planned Parenthood is for everybody but them. But we serve way more people, a more diverse group of patients than people could ever imagine. So getting the word out about that is very important. But I will say we have incredible, incredible donor support. In Montana, we have just wonderful folks who understand what we do, individuals, foundations. And of course, we, you know, there have been attempts to defund Planned Parenthood from some national funding programs, for example, Title X. And I think people are realizing that that's not a prudent idea. Even from a fiscal point of view, defunding family planning services is certainly not a great money saver to begin with. So, you know, I think we have a lot of support. We certainly want to build more supportive individuals. So we have a better ability to be flexible and to do what we need to do and serve the patients we need to serve. And of course, that takes money that can be used in a flexible way for.
But on the legislative front, it does seem like Planned Parenthood is experiencing some very significant challenges right
sure.
now. Texas comes to mind, mm-hmm. Arkansas, very expensive, fighting personhood legislation okay. in states like Colorado, Montana mm-hmm. as well. So in the end, with all the recent fundraising successes, is it a bit of a wash in the face of these ongoing, relentless legislative challenges?
You know, I think that we've done a lot of work on the political side to really get to know our legislators, to really get our stance on our issues out there, making sure people really understand what Planned Parenthood's all about. I mean, we always say more than 90% of Planned Parenthood services are basic preventive primary care. So getting that word out has actually served us really well. These constant attacks are absolutely exhausting, and make no mistake, that's what they're intended to be. There have been some victories on those fronts, but you know, it's the battle itself sometimes is the victory. So if we have to put resources into fighting political battles, we also need to make sure we have the resources to serve patients. So working to make sure that we have strong champions, to make sure that people know what it is that we do, and to talk about how it's not such a black and white issue. I mean, I don't think that family planning is a should be a partisan issue. In the past, it never was. I mean, Title X was a Republican-funded program from back in the 70s when it was started by Richard Nixon. So I think the more we can talk about those nuances, the better. But of course, it's sound bites that win the political day. It's the nuances are much harder to get across to people.
But again, your opponents, those opposed to the mission of Planned Parenthood on different fronts, still very successful. Mm-hmm. Where do you see Planned Parenthood in the next 5 to 10 years? Where do you see access to abortion rights next 5 to 10 years?
You know, it's the battle has gone to the states. It's absolutely on the state level. Right. And, you know, the idea is you know, you win or you lose, whatever happens on the state level. And, you know, the people in the states want things to go up through the courts. I'm sure that's the tactic. They haven't told me that, but it seems pretty obvious that it's to exhaust us, get cases in front of the courts, and move forward that way. But I think, again, if you talk to the average person on the street, they're starting to get a little bit tired of this. You know, if you look at what happened in Texas, there was sort of this amazing, organic, self-starting response to what was going on there in the legislature. And yeah, we have lost that battle, but the power that it's given folks who are involved in that and the feeling of empowerment, and I actually can make a difference, is huge. And I think the momentum is growing.
But in the end, 3 clinics closed, was it last year?
Yeah, because they got defunded. So, but all of that sort of it's an interesting paradox, because it's exhausting, but it's also energizing at the same time. So we have to learn to sort of gather that energy and move it forward. Because all of those folks, of course, who are standing up, maybe they can't be donors now, but down the road they might be.
You said earlier Planned Parenthood has work to do to get its message out. Work to do meaning it's not quite doing a good enough job right now?
No, I think that we've done an amazing job in terms of the work that's been going on politically. We have incredible brand recognition. Everybody knows Planned Parenthood. The thing that we have a lot of work to do on, and it's a great problem to have, is that women who are in our target age population for being patients, they know the name Planned Parenthood. They know that we're a healthcare provider, but they don't yet see necessarily what we can provide for them in terms of services. So we have a great opportunity to show people that and to say, this is what we can offer you. I'm really excited here in Montana. We have just received one of the Navigator grants. So it's a great opportunity for people who are not necessarily current Planned Parenthood patients. They'll be able to come into our health centers to enroll in insurance plans through the exchanges. We'll help them do that. And it'll just give them an opportunity to see what's going on in the health center. And that'll be available to people of all ages, you know, men, women. But it's another great way to get people in and say, this is a real doctor's office, you know. I'd like to come here as a patient. Or my daughter would really like to come here as a patient.
And as you know, this has raised the eyebrows from some Montanans, our attorney general in particular, who are concerned about the security of all this personal data during the sign-up process.
Sure.
Can you guarantee those people who are interested in signing up, their information will indeed be kept private?
Absolutely. And, you know, Planned Parenthood, one of the things we're known for is our confidentiality. People will come to us who, you know, they won't even go to their primary care doctor because they're so concerned about their reproductive health issues. So we understand confidentiality, I think, in a way that transcends even what the average healthcare provider, because our patients have such unique issues around confidentiality. So I think in that sense, we're very well prepared for that. We take it very, very seriously.
Does the Texas Medicaid fraud settlement complicate the argument a little bit?
You know, I don't think so. I can't really speak to that case, obviously, because it's a legal case and I wasn't involved in it. But I think Planned Parenthood is under such intense scrutiny for every single thing that we do, you know, on all different levels, that we're very aware of that. And honestly, we put ourselves under even more intense scrutiny than anybody else does. You know, Planned Parenthood is accountable to many more organizations, I think, than people realize. You know, we have a national federation. And of course, when we're getting grants, we have to be accountable for those. And we have very strong standards and guidelines. You know, Planned Parenthood's been around for almost 95 years, almost 100 years. So, you know, we have a long track record of serving patients well, confidential care, the best affordable care, and being good stewards of taxpayer money and of donor money.
Martha Stahl, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Montana, thank you so much for stopping by and introducing yourself.
Absolutely.
In tonight's weather forecast, across all three of our listening areas, tonight look for clear skies with lows in the 40s. Tomorrow look for sunny skies with highs in the 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Sterling Holy White Mountain.
Some of you may have noticed this past few weeks there was a bit of a dust-up in Blackfeet country regarding potential oil and gas exploration and drilling near Chief Mountain. The mountain is not only the most well-known sacred site on the Blackfeet Reservation, but is also a much-photographed tourist destination, striking both for its change in look depending on where you view it, but also for the way in which it stands apart from the rest of the mountains around it. The Blackfoot word for Chief Mountain is Minashtaku, a name that combines the words Minna, or head man, and Mishtaki, or mountain. Using the word chief in relation to the mountain is, of course, something of a mistranslation, as the word for contemporary Americans usually implies the kind of individual power Blackfeet band leaders did not have. In the centuries leading up to the dissolution of the traditional social structure in the late 1800s, the Blackfeet people, like many Plains tribes, lived in social units referred to now as bands, units that loosely consisted of blood relatives and could contain anywhere from 12 to 200 people. Band leaders were chosen by band members, and the man chosen assumed the role of leader whether he liked it or not. Because of the tremendous responsibility that went along with being chosen, the position wasn't one a man would seek, and indeed he couldn't, as such seeking was evidence of a lack of humility, and in order to lead, a man had to be humble. Among the headman's responsibilities was that of provider. Typically, a headman was better than others at accumulating material wealth, whether that be buffalo robes or horses, and as a result, he was expected to give away all of his material possessions on a regular basis, a practice that helped support those band members who were less capable or unable to provide for themselves. The man also had to be well-versed in cultural matters, and of course, he had to be able to help protect the people he was leading, a capacity I mention because so often when Americans think of American Indians, they think of warriors. And hand-in-hand with the concept of the warrior usually comes the idea of violence. But when we consider that in a band of 25 people, for example, the death or even maiming of a single male would seriously jeopardize the survival of the group, we have to reconsider this American idea of the warrior Indian always on the hunt for conflict. I would suggest instead that Plains Indian men were providers and protectors first, and that war as the way we conceive of it now was not something that existed on the plains prior to American Western expansion, at which point, of course, it was typically warfare between American cavalry and tribes, and not tribes and other tribes. So I suppose we could best summarize the duties of a headman by saying his behavior had to be in the best interest of the people he was responsible for, which is another way of saying if he didn't act in the best interest of his band, he was removed, and a new headman was chosen, which in turn is another way of saying removal from the position of headman was socially shameful, not something you would likely hear the end of in your lifetime, given how prominent the role of teasing is in Blackfeet culture. It was no small thing to be chosen as Minna, and in turn, it was no small thing to refer to a mountain as Minashtaku, a mountain that stands apart. So you can see how one might object to the use of the word Minna being translated as chief, particularly since chief in American English is directly associated with military power, and that the person in this country given the power to declare war is called the commander-in-chief. By now, given what we've been talking about, you might be asking yourself why a tribal council would give an oil and gas company the right to explore and potentially drill near a site such as Chief Mountain. However, a better question might be, I would suggest, how does a tribe get to a point where a tribal council has the power to give such permission when so many of its own people are not in favor of such an action? It's a question whose answer, in my opinion, can only come from a brief history lesson regarding land and politics in Indian country. In 1887, Congress passed the Dawes Act, a policy more commonly known as the Allotment Act. Its primary aim was to civilize, and I say civilize in quotes, the tribes by allotting tracts of land to individual Indians, and following this to teach these new landowners how to farm. The act was referred to by Teddy Roosevelt as a mighty pulverizing engine to break up the tribal mass. Opposite this perspective was the view held by tribes, that land on reservations was and should be communally held. In the process of allotting lands to Indians, it was recognized that, given that the concept of land ownership was new to tribes, it would be possible for unscrupulous non-Indians to purchase land from these tribal members without the tribal members having a full understanding of what such a sale would mean. As a result, a type of land known as trust land was established, that is, land held in trust by the federal government for Indians. This land was initially only meant to be held in trust for 25 years, a period after which the individual tribal members would assume full control of their land like any other American landowner. And just to show you how much land ownership means or meant in the philosophy of U.S. citizenship, following the end of the trust period, tribal members were made full U.S. citizens regardless of what their personal wishes were. Of course, as with most federal Indian policy, things didn't go as planned. And by the time of the Indian Reorganization Act in 1934, an act that had effectively ended further allotment of lands on reservations, the damage had been done, and over two-thirds of lands on reservations around the U.S. was owned by non-Indians. In addition to ending the allotment of Indian land, the Indian Reorganization Act also established modern tribal government in the U.S. Tribes were given the opportunity to decide whether or not to adopt a governmental model based loosely on the U.S. model. If they did accept this prefab constitution, the tribe began to govern itself according to the parameters set by this new constitution. Of course, tribes were also given the option to create a governmental structure more in line with their traditional means of governance. But Congress was less likely to approve such a structure. Most tribes took the prefab constitution, and thus we have the origins of modern tribal council, the primary governing body on most reservations around the country today. Now, to bring this narrative back to the situation at hand, one of the major functions of a tribal council is to oversee trust land owned by the tribal government. In the case of the land surrounding Chief Mountain, that land is overseen by the Blackfeet tribal government. And so while Chief is viewed as a traditional sacred site by most Blackfeet, and as a result is seen, among other things, as an important connection to the pre-contact past, it's a cultural site ultimately controlled by the tribal government, and they can do with it what they please. So imagine you find yourself with a government less concerned with important cultural sites than with revenue. And imagine finding yourself watching an oil company drill wells within 2 miles of that sacred site. And now imagine finding yourself wondering what it means to have leaders who allow such a thing to occur, regardless of what leadership meant in the past, and regardless of what drilling near a mountain with a name like Nanatsuku might imply. But then again, there's no need to imagine such a thing, is there? We're all Americans here, after all. I'm Sterling Holy White Mountain. Thanks for listening.
Sterling Holy White Mountain is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. I'm Sarah Jovetic. Thanks for listening.